My name's Mark, and I am an alcoholic. If you were here last week, you're probably aware that we had an issue with the restroom. We've been repaired. So we won't need to pass this week. It's okay. And it is now time for a newcomer app. This is the portion of the program where we put this box in the back of the room along with some pencils and some 3x5 cards, and we ask people to write down questions that they have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We put the question in the box, then we select the question to be answered using AA-approved literature and our panel of experts. Tonight's question is going to be answered by Valley Group's own Frank.
All right, thank you. I will. Thank you. I'm Frank. Glad to be here, alcoholic. Have you ever put your steps before your family? What comes first? Have you ever put your steps before your family? How many of us out there put our drinking before our family? Yeah, I did. I thought about this question. Have you ever put your steps before your family, or does your family come first? And I thought of three no's. No steps, no recovery, no family. I definitely put my drinking before my family, before my friends. I was very selfish in my drinking. But today, through this program, I have sobriety, I have hope, and there's no place I would rather be right now than right here. Because today, being here, participating, working with my sponsor, working the steps, coming to meetings, helping others, is what keeps me sober. And today I'm very grateful to be here. If I'm not spiritually fit, I am no good to anybody else, including myself. So with that, I believe your steps become first. Your steps come first. Your recovery comes first. Just like our drinking came first in many of our lives. So today I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to have 23 months sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is now time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 2003. A graduate of New Visions. She has been continually in service as a secretary, treasurer, H&I secretary, and sponsor. Her AA motto is, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, Visalia's own Michelle M.
My name is Michelle McKinney. I'm an alcoholic in support. The book talks about the alcoholic of sorts because I have other issues besides alcohol, but tonight I'm going to keep it to alcohol. I'm very nervous. I had a lot of people giving me good advice, and so one of the pieces of advice that I'm not going to use tonight is picturing you guys all naked. Because that would be kind of scary, so I choose not to do that. So I'm just going to try to use some other advice that I got, and that was talking from my heart and not my head. Like I said, I got sober in 2003. I couldn't go. I didn't go through outpatient. I wasn't able to do outpatient. I wasn't one of those kind of people that could do outpatient and stay sober. It just wasn't going to work for me. So I went through an inpatient program called New Visions after 15 years of going in and out, you know, and destroying my family's life, my life, my kids' life, and just being very, very, my life is very unmanageable, like the first step talks about. A lot of my story, though, starts from when I was a kid, which I didn't realize that until a few years into my recovery. Yeah, sure, you know, I did a lot of work with my sponsor, but it kind of, things throughout my recovery, each year, it seems like things kind of click in my head and make sense more and more. And so for you that are new here, welcome, because right now if I sound like I'm talking in Chinese, then you're probably in the right space, because that's kind of what it was like for me when I came in. I was listening to people talk, and they were saying all these things and these mottos, and they didn't really make sense to me when I was first coming into the program, because it was a new language to me. And so as years go by, you know, as you get clean and things start kicking in, things are going to start, like they say, your head is going to come out of your ass and you're going to hear the pop, and then things are going to kind of make sense for you. And that's kind of what happened to me. It was just one of those things. Everything kind of came together. So, but I realized that a lot of my drinking started as a result of a lot of trauma that I had gone through and rebellion. You know, I was a rebellious teenager, but I grew up in a household going to Christian schools. I was an only child. My mom had a lot of her own issues. She wasn't drinking or using or anything like that. There was a lot of other issues going on, mental health issues and so forth. This is my real mom. I have a stepmom. I need to make that clear. She's also in recovery, and she lives here in Visalia. When I say my mom, I'm talking about my mom, where I grew up in San Jose. So going to, you know, Christian schools and living with a mom that was very unstable. She expected a lot out of me. You know, I remember she always wanted me, she kind of lived her life through me in a way. I was always in dance and baton and, you know, whatever it was, modeling and all this stuff when I was younger. And it was like I had to be perfect. You know, I remember I was sharing with my stepmom just recently. I remember taking a picture with roses in my arms and a tiara, and I didn't even win the pageant. Okay? That's how. And I didn't win, but she wanted me to feel like I won, and she wanted to feel like she won, because it was all about her. You know, I always wanted to please her. But when I was about 10 years old, after being with my mom as an only child, you know, I'd never seen my mom with anyone before. I went to summer camp, and I came home, and it was my mom and Disco Bob, I call him, in the kitchen, you know, and it was the 80s thing, you know, Saturday Night Fever and all this stuff, right? And so they met at a disco, and it was like, that's kind of where things started to change for me, because my mom was very successful. She was very independent. She worked for Hewlett Packard, and we had, you know, like, I was very spoiled. And so we had everything, and then Bob kind of came along, and things started to change. And I remember things started to change when my mom was giving birth to my sister. She kind of had, during labor, something happened, and she got very sick, mentally ill. And she would do things like, call your grandpa and tell him to come get us right now. And he lived here in Farmersville, and my grandpa would drive 4 hours to San Jose, and then he would show up, and she'd say, I didn't say that. She's a liar. That didn't happen. So things like that would go on. So I was very confused, you know. And then a couple years later, my stepdad had lost his job, and so I went from going from a private school, wearing uniforms, and that kind of thing, very, you know, secluded and everything else, to a public school system. And it was on the east side of San Jose, and it was the worst experience of my life. I still remember it to this day because I have an earring torn out from a girl named Michelle Gomez. I'll never forget her. But anyway, yeah, I had to learn. That's when I really felt like I didn't fit in. I was very confused. I was very confused because I had, you know, that typical thing with kids with their step-parent, you know, this anger and resentment towards him. My life had changed. Everything had changed. And then I had a new sister that was, you know, she's 10 years younger than me. And I was mad. I was very mad. So the best thing that I could do would be to try to fit in with these other girls at school. I was the only white girl in my class. You know, all the other girls, they were Mexican or African-American. And the Mexican girls did not like me, so I fit in very well with the African-American girls. But I had to fight all these girls, and I had never been experienced that culture where you have to fight to earn respect. You know, I never learned that, so I went through a lot. So every day I'd come to school, and Edna would be there, and I'd have to fight Edna, and then I'd have to fight her cousin in the bathroom, and, you know, then I'd have to fight someone the next day, and it was, you know, I went through a lot of stuff. And then, it seemed like they were always setting me up, too. But anyway, you know, so before the year was over, I was, you know, it was break dancing days. I was fitting in by being on a Smurf team because I always danced, you know, for a lot of my childhood. I was, you know, jazz dance. So I fit in very well on the dance teams and stuff like that. But before you know it, I was acting like they were. I was starting to... You know, because that's what I did. I tried to fit in. So I was fighting. You know, I was carrying knives to school. I was doing all that stuff that the other girls were doing. And before you knew it, I was expelled and stuff. So that was kind of the beginning of me trying to fit in with other girls. By the time that my mom pulled me out of that school because I got expelled from school, she sent me back to the other side of town, where it was a lot, you know, I had other friends and this and that. She thought it would be better for me, and it was. It was a lot better for me. My freshman year, you know, I was a cheerleader. I had very good grades. I was doing really well. And something happened. A family friend took advantage of me, so to speak. And when I shared this with somebody at school, things changed for me. People kind of shunned me. I went through a lot of, it was rape crisis came into the school. Things like that happened to me. And my mom didn't believe me. You know, she kind of said, you know, if you weren't wearing those short skirts, if you weren't doing what you're doing, that wouldn't have happened to you. And so the only person that really... you know, believed in me was these friends of mine that weren't really too good for me. So I started doing a lot of things, like sending my own self my invitations in the mail. Heather's having a birthday party. Mom drops me off at Heather's house, and I'm out the door going to the kegger because now I'm starting to party and starting to rebel. I don't want to be at home, you know, and stuff. Because it wasn't a happy place for me to be. I was trying to escape from my house. They had came to me and told me, you know, because the unmanageability at school was already happening. I wasn't going to school. You know, I started cutting classes as a result of my partying. I'd rather be getting high or drinking instead of going to class. And they came to me and they said, you are kicked off the cheerleading squad. There's no more cheerleading. You know, that's it. And so I wanted to grow up too fast, I decided that I'd rather be on the streets and live on my own than to conform to my mom's rules and, you know, that kind of thing. Because I wanted to work, I wanted to grow up too fast, I wanted to do all those things that a lot of young girls do these days. You know, they want to grow up, they want to grow up too fast, and that's what I wanted to do. So at the age of, my years kind of run together, but probably 16 years old, I lied and said I was 18 so I could work at Mary Maid's, and I could live with people that were a lot older than me. Looking back, I'm thinking, what? I wouldn't want my child living with someone that old, but, you know, that's the way it was. And, you know, they were a lot older, and that's all we did was party. You know, I remember in the morning time, these ladies that didn't speak any English, because I'm working at Mary Maid's, they come pick me up, And I get in the car with them, and all the way to work, they'd have to pull over so I could puke on the side of the road because I'd been out drinking all night the night before, you know. And doing all the other stuff that I was doing, smoking and everything else. And so I remember that was my life. And I can't believe I was functioning, but at that time, I was able to function, hold a job, and do these things, and be acting as an adult. But something clicked in my head at 16, and I bought a car for $200, and I decided that I wanted to change. So I did what the readings talk about, and I did a geographical. I came down here to my father. He'd been in my life. I knew him. We'd spent some time together, but it was one of those things. My mom never really let me have a relationship with him. So I drove down here, and I showed up on his doorstep, and I said, "Here I am." And they said, "Come on in," and they told me that I was going to go back to school and that I was going to graduate from high school and that they were going to help me. But my addiction had already kicked in. You know, it was, yeah, I wanted to change, but, you know, I had it in me to want to continue the lifestyle of the party lifestyle, the party girl, that kind of thing. When I drove back down to San Jose to get all my stuff, because I had all my stuff was at a friend's house, I took my cousin with me, and we were drinking and Long Island iced teas and everything else, and I blacked out and got pulled over, and that's when I almost got my first DUI. And I remember the cops had me park the car, and he called my dad. Well, first he called my mom, because I was in San Jose, and she said, "Keep her, I don't want her." So, and then he called my dad, and my dad and my grandpa, my mom's dad, came from here to there to get me. And I will never, ever forget the car ride home from the police station. Yeah. It was very silent. You know, it was very silent. And my dad at the time, you know, he had a really bad temper. And it was like, I was scared to death of him, you know. And so it was terrible. But he took my driver's license from me and said, "You know what, I'm going to suspend your license for a year." So that was how that worked. I continued to sneak around. I never could be honest due to my addiction. It was like, mom and dad go to work, I have the party at my house, you know, they're playing pool, and they break the pool table light, and then, you know, I get busted, or I, you know, different things. I would always write letters to people and tell them what I was doing, and dad would get them out of the mailbox and be like, "Oh, well, where were you at, you know, blah, blah, blah." So I was always getting in trouble for partying and this and that. So I met my first love, and he was a partier, a cowboy, and so we would party a lot and drink and smoke and everything else. And one night I was smoking and not knowing what I was smoking, thought it was marijuana, but it wasn't. It was PCP. And after doing, you know, playing quarters and everything else, and I went home and I attacked both my parents. I was in a blackout. I beat him up. It was a bad situation. It was really traumatic. But of course, you know, when my grandpa came to get me, I did the good thing that good alcoholics or good addicts do, and I played the victim. Because it was all about what they did to me, you know. Don't you know that I'm the victim? And so it was a bad situation. When my grandpa came to get all my stuff off of my dad's lawn, because I was no longer welcome to live there anymore because I had made such a mess of my family's life, on the way home, he started getting very sick. And when I got off work that night from Kmart, I was told that he had a 30% chance to live. And he ended up dying that night. So for me, that was one of the biggest things I can think of that really threw me deep into wanting to self-medicate. So what better way to do that than to continue to drink and continue to use and continue to destroy people's lives? Because I was really in a lot of pain, and I didn't know that at the time, because really what I needed to do, what a normal, whatever normal is, would do, would be to grieve. And I wasn't able to grieve because I was using and drinking. And so it kind of threw me off into my addiction. And a year later, the boy that I had fallen in love with committed suicide. that made it even deeper. So by this time, I'm no longer able to work. I'm no longer able to function. And I'm still continuing. By this time now, I'm living, you know, place to place, on the streets, house to house. And really, I'm an adult, but I'm not acting like an adult. I'm just tearing up every person's life that I come across. I'm destroying their life. And so, it was a long list. When I made the powerlessness and unmanageability list, I really got a chance to look at all of the powerlessness I had over alcohol, you know, like in the readings it talks about, you know, switching from scotch to brandy, you know, all that kind of stuff. I did all that, you know. Maybe I can just drink on the weekends, you know. I'd say, oh, it's just marijuana, you know. All that thinking that we have going on in our head, it really wasn't, it was all that thinking. But the disease was very present in my life. I was the type of drinker that would go to the bar on a Friday night and intending just to have one drink. And then on Sunday morning, I was in the same clothes I left to go to the bar in, you know, because wondering how I don't have any money again. What happened? I told myself I wasn't going to do this again, you know, and I intended to call home, but after I put that drink in me or that drug in me, it changes the way I think. It changes the way how I am. And then it makes me do stupid stuff. So when they say, like, I'm allergic, you know, I break out in spots, I can, like, you know, gels, institutions, stuff like that. You know, I can relate to that because that's what happens to me. That mental obsession for the drink or the drug is more to me, more of a problem than the physical for me. Because one little drop or one hit for me, it just releases, I want more, you know, and so there's no more just one drop or one drink or one drug, you know what I mean? So that's where I was at. And then it got to the point at that time of my life that it was like, I really wanted to stop. I used to sit and cry because, you know, I really wanted to stop, but I didn't know how. And one minute I'd tell somebody, you know, I promise I'm never going to do it again. And then within 5 minutes, I was doing it again and crying because I couldn't figure out, why am I doing it again? I don't get this, you know? And so I never really understood. And everybody would tell me, you know, I would go. I thought I was crazy. I went to a psychiatrist, and they wanted to put me on lithium. But he also told me, well, if you'd stop drinking, maybe things would get better. And then my first reaction was, F you. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. It's not that. Why does everybody tell me that? But everybody was telling me that because they could see what I couldn't see. You know? And so, anyway, in that part of my life, as I was trying to self-medicate and go through all of what I was going through, I had a child. And, then immediately, like a year and a half into having her full time by myself, I went through a horrible custody battle. And I was trying to pretend because custody papers said I had to live in Santa Clara County, okay, but I didn't have a home in Santa Clara County. So I was coming here on the weekend, living here during the week. And then on the weekends, we had supervised drop-offs in Santa Clara County. So all week, I'd stay here, and I'd come down, and I'd sleep the whole week. And then I'd go back to San Jose and party the whole weekend. Okay? And it was just this insanity. And I always wanted, you know, oh, I'm going to get a house. I'm going to get it somewhere to live and snap. But it never happened. Because the problem was, is my addiction was there. You know, and it didn't occur to me that if I just stopped drinking, that I could get a job or I could get a house. But I wasn't, you know. So it got worse and worse where I ended up giving him custody of my daughter, Amber, because I knew that he could provide for her what I couldn't. But I never went back to gain the custody. And in the meantime, I have another daughter that I dragged through my whole addiction. Well, she was 5 when I got clean and sober. But so you can see 15 years of destroying people's lives, including my own children's life, as a result of alcohol and other substances. And so it was a very bad thing. So by the time that I got here, actually in 1997, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through an outpatient program in Santa Clara County. But I wasn't being honest. I was going there thinking that maybe I could just drink. Maybe I could just drink, but I'll stay clean off all the other stuff. You know, and I, because I've worked in recovery, that's very common, the thinking about, you know, well, alcohol really wasn't my problem, you know. So in 1997, I continued to drink. I fooled the counselors because they weren't testing me for alcohol at the time. And I graduated successfully. And but my alcoholism kicked in. And I remember after, you know, I don't know how many months, maybe 9 months or so, I was in a supermarket, and I was counting change counting my change, and I was shaking so bad. And I was thinking to myself, because I couldn't put thoughts together, I was thinking, what's wrong with me? What's going on with me? But what I didn't realize was I was having DTs from drinking, you know? And so later on, it was like, wow, you know, you have an alcohol problem too. And then before I knew it, I was back to the other stuff. So, and then it got worse. It progressively got worse for me. 2003, I came into New Vision through an angel, and she was a social worker through CPS. Okay, a man in my apartment complex accidentally shot himself in my living room, and he had a homemade gun, and it was an accident. He was going to shoot his dog, but the gun went off from underneath his arm when he reached for a movie that he wanted to borrow from us, and it hit the ground, and it popped and went through his neck. And immediately, it's like the moment of clarity set in for me, and I don't know why, but I was 32 years old, and I'm looking at this apartment thinking, wow, this is where your life is right now. This is where it's taking you. This disease is taking you, you know? People coming in and out at all hours of the night, rat-infested, roach-infested, you know? It was like, wow. So I called the police department, and they came, and thank God they said it was an accidental shooting because I was living in Farmersville. And his wife was mentally ill, and she had other things going on, and she was yelling, you know, they killed him, they killed him. And so it was a very scary situation. CPS came to the door the following day and said, you know, were you using and drinking? My first reaction was no. But when she left, I called her back, and I said, you know what, I was, and I want to volunteer services with you. My daughter at the time was hiding knives in my house because she thought I was going to die because I was in a very abusive relationship. So I was going to outpatient. They put me in outpatient through New Heights. And I would go there, and I would be bruised, black and blue. And I'd go home to the same lifestyle every night, and it was hard for me to stay sober, you know. And so when they called me and said, we have a bed for you, it was one of those things where it was like, it was scary, and they're like, you have 3 hours to get here. We have a bed for you at New Visions. And so my stepmom came over, we loaded up my stuff and put it in storage. And my daughter tells me, Mommy, you know, I know, my little one, she says, Mommy, I know what you've been doing. And when CPS came to the school and asked me, I lied to them. And that really touched me. And it was another part of why I knew it was time for me to get clean and sober. And I was ready to. So, I mean, for me, I haven't had a reason or good enough to have a relapse. Not saying that relapse sometimes is not part of somebody else's recovery, you know. But for me, I was within myself. I knew that I really wanted help. And when I went to New Visions, and the way that they treated me and greeted me, and I finally got to see people or hear people say to me, you know, we know where you're at, we know where you've been, we know what you've done, and we love you anyway. And that was big shit for me, because I mean, this is a girl that would walk up the driveway and people would shut the blinds. Here she comes, you know, lock your doors, you know, destroying my people's life, stealing from people, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. So when I went there, I did what they told me to do, and I got a sponsor. Her name was Vindy. She moved out of the area, but she was my first sponsor. You know, I was willing to take suggestions. And so the how, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness has played a big part in my recovery. Because without me being honest with myself and being able to be honest with other people, you know, that's it right there. You know what I mean? And so I began to get honest and teachable. So I was kind of like a robot. You know how it's real easy to follow people that are doing bad things. I don't know what it is. I used to be able to get in the car with people I didn't know, not even know them, never seen them in my whole life, but it was so hard for me to think about doing something the right way. And so I just decided that I was going to follow what other people told me to do. And so I started going to meetings through New Visions. They take us to all kinds of meetings, mainly at the Lana Club at the time, and then some at the house there. And it was a program of attraction for me. There was a lot of people in recovery that carried the message and that inspired me and gave me hope that if they could do it, I could do it. You know? And so so I listened. And all of them had the secret formula that Holden, I don't know if you guys know who he is, talks about, which is, you know, go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps, you know, get into service. And so that was what I did. That's what I did. And the steps, putting steps before your family, you have to. You know, I do this thing called 8 pieces of paper with the girls that I work with, because I work with adolescent girls. And a lot of them do not have recovery. Well, at their age, you know, I work with girls that are 14, 13. I've had one that's 13, but right now it's 14. 14 through 18. And recovery and God are nowhere on their set, on their list. They're 8 pieces of paper. And so I go around and I'll crumble up their family. I'll crumble up their, you know, their dog or their homies, which I know that's hard, but the homies. You know, they're people, places, and things, and I'll step on it with my foot, and I get really into it, and then I say, what am I? And they say, I don't know. Well, I'm the disease of addiction. Because if you don't have recovery, or the steps, the way to live life, the steps, then what do you have? You don't have anything. Because I know I don't. I don't know about you guys, but I don't. So, so the steps play a big part in our lives, you know, because it gives us an opportunity to look at ourselves, look at the damage we've done, honestly. It's hard to do. Put it on paper, look at it, and say, you know what? Wow, you know, I did this right here. And own it. And realize what happened. You know, why is it that happened? And then, you know, the relationship is a higher power. You know, about 3 years into my recovery, you know, I really wasn't, I had a relationship with a higher power because, like I told you, you know, I was raised in a Christian school. We went to church, all that kind of stuff all the time. So I knew who God was for me, my God. But the meditation, the daily meds that they talk about, things like that, I didn't have that in my life until I went through a lot of pain in my recovery. And I realized that no matter what, my higher power is always with me. Everybody else can walk away from you, but that's what I got. And it drew me closer to him. So steps 2 and 3, turning it over, you know, that's big, because I'm a person that likes to control everything around me. You know, the book talks about, you know, we want everybody to have the script. You know, everybody to talk the way we want them to talk and say the things we want them to say when we want them to say them. And when it doesn't happen that way, we get upset. And for a lot of people, that's a relapse, you know? Like, I want to get a job, and if I don't get a job, then I'm going to just drink. I might as well just drink, you know what I mean? Because it's not happening our way. So it's learning how to turn it over to our higher power and know and having faith in something we can't see. You know, if I can have faith in a GPS to get me where I need to go, you know I can have faith in God. It dawned on me one day when I was out in the boonies trying, depending on Gina to get me somewhere. You know what I mean? And it's like, why am I, and I'm a control freak, so I'm like, no, I'm just going to turn down this street. She's like, I'm recalculating. And I'm thinking, no, I know better, right? But if I would have just listened to Gina, I would have been fine all along. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have had to go 10 minutes out of my way. Well, that's kind of how it's been for me in my life. If I'm not depending on my higher power and having faith in something I can't see, then you know what? Things aren't right. Self-will sucks. And I did that in recovery. Self-will sucks. I was in a lot of self-will. I was working with women. I was, sponsoring them. And I was involved in a sponsorship group for many years. I had a really good support group. And they were telling me, kind of like with an abusive girl, or man, for that matter, if we can only give you so much advice, but if you don't take it, then I'm sorry, but we can't help you anymore. We can't watch you destroy your life. And I was like, once again, screw you guys. I know better. But you know what? That wasn't God's will for me. They knew, they could see things I couldn't see, and I wasn't willing to take suggestions. So I went through a lot of pain for a while until I was able to turn it over, see God's will, not Michelle's will, but God's will, and things got better. So first year of my recovery, I went back to school. I got out of New Visions. Actually, Dana was my first counselor over there. And she told, I didn't want to leave. I was scared to death. I didn't want to go because I just knew. They kept telling me, the visa's out there doing push-ups. It's going to meet you at the door. And that's what usually happens. So I extended so I was there for 120 days, and she finally said, you know what, you need to go. You need to do this on your own. You need to fly out of your nest, little birdie. That's what she told me. So I said, okay, and I did, and I was scared to death. So I put myself on a schedule. Schedule's really important, the first, of your recovery structure. And I started getting into service. I was a secretary for the Powder Puff Girl Women's Group at the Alana Club every Saturday at 12 o'clock. That's where I went. And I hated it at first because I didn't really care for women all that much. But that's where I had an opportunity to start meeting people, shaking people's hands, giving them hugs like we just sit up here, and getting to know people in recovery because I had to change my people, places, and things. I started going to the Alana Club, sweeping, hanging out, doing the Nooners group, things like that. So for the first year of my recovery, I was very blessed. I was able to just focus on my recovery. I ended up going back to school because I have a past, and I had 5 years of not working. I was a welfare recipient for 5 years, and I didn't have any work history. So when I went to go get jobs, they were like, well, we need to see 6 months of, job history or, references, and I didn't have that. And so I went to Golden State College for medical billing, and I started doing medical billing for Sequoia Regional Cancer Center, and that's kind of what got me started in the workforce. And eventually I began to work with the Tulare County Drug Court. And so not only was I working a program of recovery in my personal life, working steps with a sponsor, working on myself, but I was also working with other alcoholics and addicts. And that's been a big part of my recovery, is the sponsoring and working with women in recovery and men, because I was able to give back. And that's what this program's about. That's what life's about, is giving back to the community where you live. Because there's so many people that are suffering, not only us, but other people. And so being there for other people, really helps me, today, I have a relationship with that little girl that I wasn't there for 6 years, when she was 12 years old, I got full custody of her. And it was one of those things where it was a God shot for me, having my parents back in my life. My dad and I didn't talk for 10 years after that situation with my grandpa because I couldn't forgive him. I was really angry about that. But it really wasn't any, we worked it out. When I got sober, things started to change for me. you know, it healed my family. So we got our relationships better. Both my parents are in recovery, which is a blessing. And that happened after I got clean and sober. I had, like I said, my daughter Amber, she came back, I got full custody of her, and it was really tough because she was me when I was her age. And so the only way that I would have been able to help her is if I, since I went through the program and I had been introduced to AA and been given the tools that you guys gave me to learn how to live life and stuff, that's the only way I knew how to help. That's the only way I would have been prepared to help her. So God set that up for me, you know. And so I was able to benefit her life and help her. So she's 17 now. She graduated from high school, and I feel like it was kind of like that cycle. I took her in like my dad took me in. I helped her as much as I could, and it was hell for a long time. You know, it was, because she was the one sneaking out and doing all that stuff, just like I was. But, you know, that's what we get. And so, and now she's working and she's successful, and I'm very blessed with the life that I have today. I really am. I work, like I said, with adolescents. I work in Fresno, so I commute over there. And it's a challenge because I'm working with different cultural stuff, and the gangs and all that. And it's, and like I said, it's a challenge. But I get to carry the message of what you guys gave to me into them and be hope for them and share with them what I went through and share with them what they can have and introduce the steps to them. It's not a 12-step based program over there like it was here when I was working in this community, but I do it in a roundabout way. I don't put step one or step two. I introduce it to them in a different way, and I work it with them on their resentments and their character defects, all that stuff. So, you know, my recovery is a blessing. My life is a blessing today. And I know that if you would just give it 6 months, a year, to do what they're suggesting that you do, you know, your life could change too. And if it doesn't change, you can always go back and do what you were doing before, and I hope you don't. But, you know, because you can have a better life. And this program, the AA Fellowship, will open their arms to you and welcome you back whenever you're ready. So thank you very much for letting me come tonight and be here with you and share my story with you. And I'm glad you guys all still have your clothes on. And you have a good night. Thank you.